Okay. So what I want to do today is, as I said, this year I want to divide the halakhic topics that we explore into two types of topics. Right? Sometimes we will take topics that have been, well written on by contemporary poskim and sort of analyze methodologically what is that they're doing, what choices are they making, what's motivating them, how are they dealing with the complexities of the halakhic process, and how has that been compounded by the factors that modernity introduced into the discussion. And sometimes we're going to try to take topics that have been less than fleshed out by contemporary poskim and try to give our own perspective on it. So considering that, despite the fact that it's our second week, Rosh Hashanah is already, Sunday night. Do we have Shir? Do you know? Do we have Shir next Wednesday on the fast?
Yes.
Yeah, normal day?
We have half day.
So in the morning we still have. So you don't know. Okay, so I assume we'll meet next week also then. That'll be my guess. I have to look at the form. But I figured we'd do something which is a bit contemporary halacha and sort of get us in the theme of the Yom Narayim as well. So last year, I wrote a series for the virtual Beit Midrash, for the VBM, on halacha in the age of social media. And what I was doing was essentially taking halachic questions that I thought had not been dealt with and trying to analyze in what ways has communication technology in general and social media in particular affected the way we think about halacha in very varied areas of halacha. So some of the topics were obvious, but also I think less interesting, like questions like Lashon Hara and things like that, which are basically obvious. Social media, communication technology in general hasn't changed that much. It just made it easier to talk about other people, to spread information. But there are ways in which halacha has been radically changed. So just to give you an example before we go to the ones we're going to deal with today, an area you might not think of, which is affected by it, is the area of Hilchot Brachot. But there are actually two brachot that, in many ways, encapsulate some of the issues that social media raises. The Gemara tells us that if you haven't seen a friend in 30 days, so then what bracha do you make? Shechayanu. And what if you haven't seen a friend in 12 months, what bracha do you make, according to the Gemara? So the bracha of Mechaya Meitim. Good, that was a good reaction. Mechaya Meitim, why Mechaya Meitim?
Didn't know that they were alive until you...
Exactly, because you didn't know that they were alive. There was a real doubt, presumably there was a real doubt in your mind as to whether this person was indeed alive.
What if you've been in contact with them?
Good, and that is the question that started being asked. This is not a new, totally new question. The question started being asked several hundred years ago, once communication technology was introduced into the world, and by that I don't mean what we have. I mean... So letters, good, but what technology, and you don't even think about this technology, but what change happened that affected letters that made this different? So not even the printing press, that's true, but even simpler. Trains, boats, right, high-speed boats, think about it. It's true people always wrote letters, but how long did those letters take to get there? Right? And a very long time. Meaning, yes, you had letters, but how often were you in contact with someone? Meaning, this is not even so new. Like, my mother was in the Peace Corps in the 70s in Botswana. And when she wrote letters to her parents in America, right, letters, even then, took 6 weeks in each direction. Right? And that was with planes and etc., you know, and everything that we have. But Poskim already started asking the question, okay, well, what happens if you've been in contact with someone in such a way that you realistically have no doubt, right? In reality, you have no doubt that they are alive, but you haven't seen them. So when you see them for the first time, do you make a bracha? Now, what is that question? So that question is really asking two things. One is, what is the nature of these brachot? Yeah.
Oh, I was
going to
ask a question.
Yeah.
For us, like when you're like someone younger, like wouldn't you just assume that you would have
death.
Good. So that's yeah, I feel that. Right.
Like, wouldn't you just like assume like, okay, you would have heard about like a new song?
Good. So what? Shira, right? Shira?
Shayna.
I'll get it. So what Shayna notes is what several contemporary postkin have noted, that the original postkin who started asking this question when communication technology improved, boats and telegrams and things like that, they were asking in a time where, okay, what if I've actually been in contact with someone? How does that affect these halachot? But then, at some point, whenever it was, we crossed to a totally new shaila, a totally new question, which is not what happens if you've been in contact, but what if the world is so connected that the default is that they're alive, unless you've heard otherwise, right? What does that do, right? Now it's not positive knowledge, right? Letters is positive knowledge. What about negative knowledge, which has been affected by this, right? Yeah.
Are these shilas asked mostly out of curiosity, not out of consequences?
Well, the halakhic consequences as follows, right? You haven't seen your friend in a month, and now you see them. Your best friend, you haven't seen them in a month, now you see them. But you've been in contact every single day. You've called, you've texted, you've WhatsApped, you've FaceTimed, you've whatever, right? Instagrammed, I don't know. Whatever, everything, right? Do you say Shechianu? Have you ever heard anyone say it? No, except, right? And again, maybe we can do this topic more in depth at some point, but I just want to throw out an example. So, the Rav Yaakov Chagiz in the Halacha Ketana was asked this question. He said, well, there's a difference. The bracha of Mechaye HaMeitim is based on, right? Why do you say the bracha of Mechaye HaMeitim? Because what? Right? Or, in other words, you're actually, right? It's an information-based question. Right? I actually thought they were dead. So when I see them, and they're not dead, that is novel to me. So I say Mechaye HaMeitim. But Shechianu, why do I say Shechianu if I haven't seen a friend in 30 days?
Because they're a new thing.
Yeah, I mean new in what sense, right? Why do you say Shechianu? You say it on new things because?
They're good.
Right, they're good. The excitement. It's a bracha on excitement for a Shechianu v'kimanu, right? You brought us to this exciting event, time, Yom Tov, new fruit, new clothes, whatever. Right, there's a newness here. So Rav Yaakov Chagiz says, well, Mechaye HaMeitim, I don't say if I've been in contact because I'm aware that they were alive. But what about Shechianu? Shechianu, I would say. Yeah.
And what if you're, you haven't texted someone?
Good. So then, if you move to modern poskim, really modern, Rav Ovadia Yosef will start asking questions. Okay, that's Rav Yaakov Chagiz. Now, the Mishnah Berurah denies this. The Mishnah Berurah says Shechianu is like Mechaye HaMeitim. Neither of them will you say in a communicate, right, a world connected by communication technology, right? But let's take for a moment Rav Yaakov Chagiz, there are Chasholchan, Rav Ovadia Yosef. Rav Ovadia Yosef said, what happens if you have been in active contact? Right? You've called, you've texted, you've been in contact with them every single day. So fine, Mechaye HaMeitim is information-based. I won't say Mechaye HaMeitim. There are some poskim who say you still what, but let's assume you don't. What about Shechianu? What do you think?
Yes.
You say yes. Why?
Because my best friends live really far away from me, and I see them, never, basically. And it's fun and all to text them, but, it's so exciting whenever I get to see.
Good! So that's exactly what Rav Ovadia Yosef says. Rav Ovadia Yosef says, well, what is Shechianu? Shechianu is about joy. And nothing replaces face-to-face contact with your friends. Ha'itrakshut, ha'rikshit, dot, right? The emotional excitement that you have when you see your friends, right, is fundamentally different. Now, this area of halacha, right, let's assume we take Rav Ovadia. That means if you've been in contact with someone, so then, and you haven't seen them in a year, do you say Mechaye HaMeitim? No. But if you see them for the first time in 30 days, do you say Shechianu? Yes. Now, if we sort of abstract it for a minute, what is that? What is this very brief exercise in halakhic analysis? What does this tell us about halakha? Right? What does halakha shed light on? Yeah.
I mean, that things can change with the time.
Well, what can change? Right? What is Rav Ovadia essentially arguing? He's saying that communication technology has changed what, and has it changed what? It's changed.
It has changed, even communication
Good. Or information, let's say information-based halakha would have changed. But? Yes. But emotion-based halakha, right? Experiential halakha actually hasn't changed. So this sort of very narrow halakhic question of do you make Shecheinu Mechayim Eitzim is actually a statement where halakha can weigh in and say, communication technology has changed the way we receive information, but certain basic human experiences, the excitement of seeing your friends, right? Think about it. The friends were in contact. I'll pose it, I think, in the sharpest way I can, right? Who are you more likely to go out of your way to meet up with in person? The person who you've been in contact with every day or the person you haven't bothered being in contact with every day?
The person you've been in contact with.
Right, right? Meaning there's a reason. We all understand that the people we're closest to are specifically the people we want to see in person because we recognize that there's something different about that type of interaction. But halakha actually has a language for that and either reflects or captures the reality of human relationships versus mere information in this halakhic, by this little halakhic thing. Now, that point, that basic insight has drastic ramifications in areas of halakha that you would not think of at all. So, just to take one example, and then we'll move to our example. The reality that nowadays communication technology is so good that people are in contact all the time, and as Shana pointed out before, it's so good that even if I haven't heard from someone, I'll assume they're alive because there's a presumption that bad news travels, right? If God forbid something happened to them, I would get some update from somewhere. That spills over into, throughout an area of halakha that you don't think it spills into, I don't know. This is like throwing out.
Shlishut?
What?
Shlishut? Like a messenger?
So it actually does in certain, that's good, right? It does in certain messenger agency questions. That insight spills over. What area might it spill over into that? Well, you know, you're not going to guess it. I'd be very surprised. It spilled over into the debate amongst poskim after 9/11. Women whose husbands had been in the Twin Towers and then disappeared, presumably dead. In halacha, there's a category called mayim she'en lahem sof, right? The classic aguna in halacha is not someone whose husband withholds a get. It's a husband who
disappears.
We're uncertain whether he's dead. And the classic case in the Gemara is what's called Maim She'en Lahem Sof. A person falls into a body of water that you can't see the end of it. So therefore, you can't be sure that he drowned rather than floated out to sea and landed on some desert island somewhere. That woman is a classic aguna. But in the post-skim, then after 9/11, started asking the question, well, if halakha recognizes that the reality has changed such that if someone doesn't want to be lost, it is almost, right, it is very easy for them to find, at least after passage of time, to find a way of contacting. And even if the person fell out of the Twin Towers and was unconscious and ended up in a hospital, the world is connected such that they would try to figure out who this person is, right? Whether they have to use DNA or dental record, whatever they have to, right, to figure out who this person is. If they were alive, they would contact their wife, assuming there's no reason to believe that he would want to run away and use this as an excuse to escape from his marriage. Can we use the fact that we haven't heard from him as a piece of evidence to allow his wife to remarry? And the poskim said, yes! Because the same insight that says we don't say mechaya meitim in this world because the world is connected in such a way means that in agunot, it's actually harder, right? Disappearing for a while might actually be evidence of death. Right, so my point is simply that these halachot, right, and these sort of questions of how has technology shifted the way halacha functions spills over into many areas of halacha that are totally unconnected, but at their core, they're actually, right, conceptually similar. So what I want to do today is we'll see how many we get through. I put three here, but maximum would do two, but probably we'll stick with one and maybe do another one next week. Yeah.
And then after 5 years, you find their remains. Do you have to start Shiva then?
You sit one day of Shiva. It's called a shmua rechoka. Right, there's two types of aveilut. Right, this is at the very, very end of Shulchan Aruch. One is called shmua krova, and that's when you hear someone's death in somewhat real time. And then there's shmua rechoka, right, where you heard about it way after it happened, which was a very common thing in the ancient world. Right, meaning back to the communication issue. Right, with lack of communication, it wasn't impossible that you didn't find out that even one of your seven close relatives passed away. Right, but you only found out 2 years later. Right, so there you sit a cut down, right, a truncated form of Shiva. You know, it doesn't happen so often. It does happen, right? Like it happened with Zachariah Baumol, right? When they found his body after 25 years. Remember, you were following this a few months ago,
yeah.
Right? Zachariah Baumol had been one of these people captured in the Lebanon War, the first Lebanon War. Right, and they didn't know where his body. They weren't sure if he was alive or dead for the last several decades. Right, and then they finally, in a deal, right, Russia found his remains and returned it to Israel, and they could finally sit Shiva. Right, it was whatever it was, 25, 28 years. I forget how many years. Right, it happens. Right, rarely, and we usually hear about them because they're particularly tragic cases. Okay. So here's what I want to do before Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Something that has bothered me, and I think about pretty much every year, probably starting next week, is, I don't know about you, but if I go on to Facebook, or I check any of my WhatsApp groups, or any of those things about Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur time, suddenly I start getting mass apologies. Anyone else get these?
Yeah.
Right? I hope that all, in the spirit of Yom Kippur, I hope that all people, all my friends who I might have offended, I don't remember what I did to you during the year, but if I've done anything, I hope that everybody reading this finds it in their heart to forgive me, and I forgive everybody for anything you might have done. You've gotten these, right? It's the, you know, when we were like five, we did this in, you know, you do this in like kindergarten, you go around and ask mechila from your friends, and now we sort of do that kindergarten style, but we do it to 1,000 people, and we think that that's an expression of sincerity or something like that, right? We all do this. Let me ask you the question. Is there any value to that? Halachically speaking, right? Asking for forgiveness is actually a halachic, right, obligation, right? If you have wronged someone, as we'll see, and this is the first source on the page, right? And we all know this. We learned this when we were little kids. Right? In order to get kapara, to get atonement for the sins between people, in addition to all the standard parts of tshuva, right, and regretting the sin and committing not to do it again and vidui to God, right, all of our shamnus, we all know that if we wrong someone else, we need to ask them for their forgiveness. Does this, right? Well, very common phenomenon where people pre Yom Kippur don't bother going to every single one of their friends and asking them in person, but they do it through this impersonal, often mass means, does that do anything? Is that halachically significant? Now, it sounds like a simple question, but let me ask you, and then I'll give you the sources. What does it even hang on? Where would you even look? Right? What is the question? What am I asking? You might have intuitions about it. Maybe even before I look at the sources, what are your intuitions? Right? Does that work? Is it meaningful?
What are the requirements for like a full mechila?
Good. You got to figure out what are the requirements and does this count? Now we have to ask we have to divide this question into two possible scenarios. Two possible scenarios. Right? You can have someone post a mass apology and their friends read it and their friends forgive them. Right? That's one possibility. Does that count? Possibility two is someone, right, people read it and they don't forgive them. Now, in the second case, right, if you post a mass apology and you ask for forgiveness and people don't forgive you, so then the answer is pretty easy, which is
no.
No. Right?
It's like all
right.
Or none.
What?
It's like all people.
No, not necessarily, but we'll see that, right? Not necessarily all or none, but let's assume there was someone who you actually wronged, and now you posted, they read it, they don't forgive you, so you, right? Yeah.
Like,
But for argument's sake, wouldn't that still be the case if you were to do it on an individual basis?
Yes, for right. sure.
So the possibility is the same.
Correct, so. Correct. So definitely if they said no, right, it's no better than in person, but we'll see. Right, what's the halacha in person? If so, if you ask someone forgiveness and they don't forgive you, what's the halacha?
Then you ask them again.
You gotta ask them again.
But don't you have to like wait a certain period of time?
Yeah, right. You can't just say forgive me, forgive me.
If someone's scrolling through Facebook and they see a methodology, and one person is like, you know what? Yeah, I do forgive that person, and another person is like, no, they should do it to my face. Like this is really, it's just not enough for me. Or it was like so bad that I don't want to forgive them at all, even if they ask me in person. You're not gonna know what each person.
Good. Does. So there's a right. There's a epistemic problem here, which is even if they forgive you, you won't know. Right, so clearly this is not the best, right, that's for sure, right? But let's say for the 90% of people that whatever I did to them is not so bad, they're actually willing to forgive me. Okay, let's assume there's 10% of people, and those are the people I should know, right? If I really wronged you to that point where you're not willing to forgive me, I have to really work at it, fine. But let's say for 90% of people, do I get anything from apologizing like that? Or let me push it farther. This is the case where I feel like intuition in the room is, that's not so great. Okay, let me change it. You directly contact them, but not in person. Right? You text them. Does that work? Does that count? Why yes, why no? Yeah.
I feel like it would count more than just posting a mass apology because the person I don't really know how much it matters whether or not someone actually forgives you. I feel like it's more important that you're recognizing that you did something wrong and asking them.
So good. So I think you're already on the right track here. In terms of the halachic question, right? The halachic question here really is, right? Right. Now we've moved to the kitchen, which is a little bit more subtle, which is, can I directly contact you, but, right, not in person? Well, the question there is, well, right, the question we really need to ask halachically is, right, think about it, and there's halacha, right? What do we need to figure out? Let's just get this out. What do we need to ask? We need to figure out what is the halachic requirement, right? What is it that I'm supposed to accomplish with an apology? Right? And then I have to figure out, do I accomplish it through a mass apology or even a personal apology, but where I don't do it in person? Yeah.
If you like do something to someone earlier in the year and then you ask them for forgiveness like a week later, then that's like the time.
Yeah, you don't have to do it again, Yom Kippur. Correct. You don't have to do it again at Yom Kippur. Right? Yeah.
To respond to your earlier question, wouldn't it just depend on how much you text? Like, if you're someone who texts all the time, then maybe that regularity would, like, underscore the sincerity of your apology as opposed to someone who doesn't text.
Maybe, right? I've heard people suggest this, but let me give you some food for thought when you're thinking about it, right? Do we assume that text is a good means of communication for all types of conversations?
No.
Give me an example of types of things that we really don't like people texting for. We think it's just really a jerk move to do that. Yeah. Yeah, right? That was the example I was thinking about, right? People really don't like, right? It's, for most people, considered an offensive thing for someone to, let's say, break up by text, especially with someone they've been going out with for a while, not like, I don't know, right? But most people think that's offensive. Why? Why do you think that's offensive? Why do people, right, why is that like the plot in like, why is that the plot in sitcoms, right? Like, why?
Because if your relationship means something to someone that you love, that you would, I don't know, like make more of an effort than do something that's so easy to do that you don't even have to face
that. Okay, so you said two things there, right? One is effort, but the other is, now I want to, right, this is, I want you to think through halacha, right, about the Amnara'im. The second is that we all feel like texting is a way of not facing people, right? That's why sometimes, right, and this is becomes more and more a thing, some people just don't like when you call them at all, right? Just text me. I don't want to call, I don't want the awkwardness, I don't want, right? I would just rather, for most things, like text me so I don't have to have human interaction at all. And we realize that if someone breaks up by text, they're trying to do it because they don't want that discomfort of facing someone face to face. Now, even a phone call. What about a phone call? Right? What do you think? So, right, you got to wonder, right? So you'll say, well, on the one hand, yeah, you're facing them. On the other hand, couldn't you say that to my face? Right? We'll say that. Can't you? Right? If we've been in a relationship for 6 months, right, you want to break up, say it to my face. Right? Force yourself to look me in the eyes and say that. Right? Even phone, right? Even by calling someone, you're saving face. But now let's come back to this question, right? The halachic question we need to ask, and we got to figure out how you figure this out is, what is the purpose? What is the halachic requirement of an apology? Right? Now, if it's about, in some way, I forget who said it, like humbling yourself. Did you say that? Yeah. Maybe, I don't know. Or facing up to what you did wrong, actually admitting it, right? Actually changing, right? It's more about you than them, right? It's about the process you go through. So then we're going to tend to think that what? Any mode that allows me to save face is going to be, right? Or not an usher, but won't fulfill what I need. Good. And this is, so remember our, right, remember our prongs, right? So now let me outline the question we're going to have to figure out, right? The prongs of things that we have here. In any halachic question we have, right, we have the original source. We have precedent. Custom. Right, from here we generate, right, a theoretical psak, right? But then we need to
consider the circumstances.
Right, then we need to apply it. Right, we need to assess the reality. So methodologically, how are we going to analyze this question? So the first thing we have to do, custom's not going to help us very much, but we're going to have to use the original sources and probably minimal precedent, right? But some precedent to figure out what counts as an apology in halacha, right? What counts? What is the purpose in halacha? But then, we're going to have to spend time here, which is, okay, whatever we think you need for an apology, is it accomplished by X, Y, and Z? Right? And a lot of the work, some of the work is going to be done at this level, is generating a theoretical model, but half the work is going to be done here, which is, be careful, and half of it is going to be, right, not generating a theoretical model, but we could all have a dispute right here. Like, let's say we all said, right, you have to communicate in a way that is natural, right? You can't, for whatever reason, right, you can't do it in a way that is, it might, as one of my students at Migdal said when I posed it to this question to them, they said, it might depend. Are you, right, under 25 or over 25, or under 30 or over 30, right? If someone in their 50s or 60s, right, who they still, right, grew up, their entire life was not with this, and this is like, right, this is not their primary mode of communication, right, it's really a cop-out. For some people, right, you know, we're just used to it, whether it's, yeah. How can that affect halacha? So that's a good question. Well, you tell me. How can it affect halacha?
Are more used to using Facebook, this is okay.
Ah, good. Why do you think that?
Because it's not law can't be subjective.
Ah.
And it could be up to interpretation, and people get confused, and then some people could feel bad about doing it and not do it, even if it's allowed, and other people who shouldn't be doing it could do it.
So, I'll push you on this.
Okay.
Right? Let me, like, again, like I said, my goal this year is to give you halachic questions. This one's a relatively easy one, but one that will force you to think about halachic process. So, right, remind me your name. Elisheva points out correctly, normally in law, we shy away from ambiguous sliding scale standards. We like formality, but not always. When don't we? What? Give me an area of halacha. I just mentioned one. Give me an area of halacha where we don't. So if I go back to the example I gave at the beginning. Saying Shechayanu, who do you say Shechayanu on? What do I say?
A friend.
So you know what the poskim say? Or the Rishonim? Which friends do you say it on?
Your
The well, which ones? See, this is careful. They say only those who you like and actually feel that joy. But if it's someone, and so you'll tell me, well, I feel joy for my 100 closest friends. And someone else will say, well, I only feel that joy for my 5 closest friends. Someone else will say, only for my best friend. And you know what the postcum say? Yes, exactly. It's about your emotional state. Certain halachot capture human experience. And then, just like human experience is different for different people, the halacha is indeed different for different people. Right? Good. So what you're pointing out is that this is going to be a hard rule to set up. But what if I said, I'm not going to set up a rule. What if I said, the standard I'm going to set up is apologize in a way that will be meaningful to the person you're apologizing to. What if I said that's the rule?
That's different.
Okay, but now, and what if, but now do you understand how I could just flip it like that, and now the standard might be, well, it really depends. If someone grew up on this technology and is actually okay with it, right? I'd venture to guess, that for a lot of people who grew up on this technology, grew up and had a smartphone since they were very young, and they have very good friends that they really just never see, right? Maybe a friend from camp that lives on the other side of the country. They see them just during the summer, and during the rest of the year, maybe they'll FaceTime, okay? I would venture to guess that for most people, at least many people, who are of that age group, maybe your age group, I'm just guessing, if you took the effort to FaceTime one of your camp friends who you wronged and apologize face-to-face, right, on FaceTime, that would be, right, that's about all I can do. I'm not flying out, right, I live in New York, I have a friend in LA, right? I'm not going to fly out 5 hours, but I'm going to face you face-to-face, right, that's about as close as I could get, right? We could sort of imagine that, emotionally that would work, right, for that person. But we all understand that if you did the same thing to someone in their 80s, right? Like, you know how much, right, how difficult it is for some people's grandparents to figure out how to use Skype, right? Right? Like, you'll try, you'll do your best, right? You'll go on FaceTime, you'll go on Skype, and inevitably the camera will be, right, facing off towards the wall, they can't see you.
What?
Exactly, right? And if I said to you, wait a second, you have to do something that's going to be meaningful, right? You're trying to appease someone. You have to do something that's meaningful to them. So for someone your age who knows what they're doing and it's face-to-face, that's fine. But you can't do that for someone who doesn't really, right? They will never quite feel that it's the same as face-to-face. You'd say, right? Is that a subjective standard or sliding? Yes, but it's also one that sort of makes sense, right? Meaning certain areas of halacha, even though they're halacha, they're law, the standard is more subjective. Because that's the nature, that's the name of the game, that's the nature of the halacha. Right? And I think, depending on how we view apologies, right, and why we apologize, and why we have to ask for forgiveness, and what are we trying to accomplish, and what is the halachic standard, it might actually be a flexible application. Right? As annoying as that is in law, and as much as we shy away from it, right, sometimes we have to do that. Right? The same way, I'll give another example from a different area of halacha. The halacha is that you're supposed to treat Shabbos differently than the regular week. Right? What does that mean?
No technology.
Great, no technology. But already in the Yerushalmi says, if you are a Talmid Chacham, you know what you should do on Shabbos?
Not study.
Sleep. Yes, you should sleep. And if you're not a Talmid Chacham, you know what you should do on Shabbos?
Study.
Study. Right? That's a subjective standard, right? If you spend your week learning, right? Or you look at any modern post game. Is it good to play board games on Shabbos? Well, they'll tell you. It depends. What are you going to be doing otherwise? Right? Are you playing board games as a way of escaping from learning? Maybe you should think about going to that cheer. Are you playing board games so that, because, you know, that's... Yeah, it's a good way of spending time with your family, which you never get to do during the week, and the alternative is that you are going to, I don't know, all curl up in your own corners with a book and not talk to your family ever, right? Maybe that's a very productive way, right? Is that a sliding scale? Yes. But what's the standard? The standard isn't you are or not allowed to play board games. It's Shabbos should be different. Shabbos, right? Shabbos should have a unique spirit to the day. That means different things for different people, like actually, right? And halacha recognizes that. That's actually legitimate, right? Not... And for this alone, right, this is why taking halachic cases is helpful, right? It's important to recognize that, yeah, you're normally we would like law to be uniform, but not all of law allows itself to be uniform. We just have to be okay with that. Yeah.
What I'm saying, it's not the ambiguity that's inherent in the problem. It's like the question that I was like, I had a problem with, or maybe I guess the statement was like, the rule being, if you are from a generation that isn't, and then, like, is, like, I think...
Good, so you're right on that, right? It's not a rule, right? It's, right, this is, right, if I said that as a rule, I think you'd be right, right? I can't say, if you're below 30, yes, above 30, no. I can say, an apology means you have to communicate with someone in a way that they will be willing to accept, right, your conversation, and then we'll all understand that the application process is not in the POSIX hands. Right, this is, right, you got to know your friend or your family member, right? So what I want to do, now we've sort of outlined the theoretical issues, I want you to go through these sources. One, the sources here, try to get through 1 through 5, okay? These sources end on number 7, I only gave you 7, right? And then, but try to get through 1 through 5, take like half an hour, and then we'll reconvene and talk about it. Now, on this sheet, I also gave you 2 other topics. I gave you briefly my thoughts on how tefillah has changed in the world of social media, which I don't really want to get into. Maybe we'll do next week. And this is, I think, actually a harder shaila, so I wanted to keep it, but I think a more interesting one. But again, we got to sort of... Right, that's one that really takes a lot of halachic analysis, is the question of... I sort of prepare this as a pre... Yom Narayim theme. So tshuva, tefillah, and staka. Staka is actually an area of halacha which I think has radically, radically changed. And that, in a nutshell, is because in classic literature, who do you owe staka to first?
Those in?
Good. Ani, what the Gemara calls ani ircha, right? The people in your city, right? The problem is we all know that who do we give staka to? Who does everyone give staka to? Organizations that they? That they?
Like.
Thank you. That they like, they identify with, right? Now there's been this shift that's almost unspoken, that people have stopped giving to their geographic charities and given to their ideological charities, right? That's actually a move in halacha that I think has, right, we would have to analyze and has a lot of reverberations, right? I doubt we'll have time to do it today. But I think it's actually, right, highlights a lot of problems in contemporary halacha. But let's start on this smaller question of tshuva. Try to get through sources 1 through 5. Again, take like half an hour. And then, right, try to analyze the questions we've been talking about and see how they actually fit into the sources and develop an opinion on it. Right? Be the posig and try to generate a policy statement that you would encourage to your community pre Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. Did I give you 2? There you go. Okay. So let's try to do this a bit methodologically here, okay? What is the original source? All right, where are we going to start with this question to analyze what is an apology and how can you, what counts for halakhic purposes? So what's the original source? Yeah.
Are you asking me, like, what's the name of it, or, like, what does it say?
Well, both. Let's do both.
Okay, so the Mishnah Yoma in Parakat says...
Good. So Mishnah is about as primary as we can get, right? So here, our primary source is the Mishnah in Yoma. Good. So what does the Mishnah in Yoma say?
It says that if you aggravate your friend, or like you have to, you don't like, you don't have like a Yom Kippur or whatever until they've.
Well, you don't have, right, meaning, yeah, like, you don't get atonement, right?
Until Achi or Tsefaviro, until, like, goodwill is restored between
right.
you.
Right, good, until you appease your friend. So let's, right, so let's just analyze it, okay? So let's get a little bit of Yom Narang talk here. So normally, I'm sure you have seen this at some point, a sin between you and God, what do you need to get atonement? Right, you need tshuva. What does tshuva consist of?
Vidui.
So that's one of it, right?
Oh, harata.
You have to admit that you good. Did something wrong.
Harata. Good, right? You need regret. Right? The last thing you need is vidui, right? You need to...
Wait, I thought there was... The last one was like you were saying you're not going to do it again. And then vidui was the third step.
Whatever direction you want to do it, right? Kabbalah alat, right? Azivat achet. Right? Leaving the sin. Right? Kabbalah alatid. Right? Committing not to do it again. And vidui. Okay? Now, in addition to that, for all of this is for, right, Ben Adam Lamakom. But then when you add Ben Adam Lachavero, in addition to all of this, you need what the Mishnah calls, right, Yiratzed Chavero. Right? You need to appease your friend, you need to get forgiveness from the person that you wronged, okay? This is our primary source, right? Is this principle. This is what we need to define. Yiratzeh et chavero. Okay, just to look at it inside, right? You get, right, the key line here, just on the third line, or really one line up from that, right? Averot sheben adam lemakom yom kippur mechaper. Right? This plus Yom Kippur gives you kapara. Right? Equals kapara on Yom Kippur. But for interpersonal sins, you need this.
Right? Averot sheben adam lemakom Yom Kippur mechaper. Averot sheben adam lechavero. Ein Yom HaKippur mechaper ad sheyiratzeh chavero.
Okay. Now, The we'll come back to the second half of the Mishnah, but what does the second half of the Mishnah introduce?
Right, the second half of that Mishnah introduces a discussion from Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah and Rabbi Akiva that says what? Anyone do that?
Rabbi Elazar says the same thing as the Mishnah says, like in the same words.
Okay, good.
And then
but he gets it from a pasuk, right? So now, if we want, right? Right, original source Mishnah, but technically, right, now we have the Pasuk, right? Right, what does the Rabbi Elazar say the Pasuk is? Which Pasuk is it?
Vayikra in Perek, Zion. Mikol chatosiyachem b'nei Hashem
titaru. Right, so what does he say? Right, sounds like, right, how does he read that Pasuk? Something like, right, if it is just ben adam lemakom, then lefnei Hashem titaru, right? Then it's just before God, right? But ben adam lechavero, in addition to being in front of God, right, your friend is part of it, or something like that, right? What does Rabbi Akiva say? Right, Rabbi Akiva introduces a mashal, and he says, "Ashreichem." Sorry, he says, "Ashreichem Yisrael, lefnei mi atem mitaharin umi mitaretchem avichem shebashamayim." He said, God, right, you're lucky because God purifies you. God purifies the Jewish people like a mikveh, and we will come back to that in a minute. But okay, but this is the original source that we're trying to analyze. This notion of ritsui. The Gemara clarifies this a bit in number two. The Gemara in Yoma and Daf Pei Zayin. What does the Gemara say? Right. What does the Gemara add to this conversation? What does it mean to? Right. What does it mean to be meratzel chavero? Yeah.
Sorry for the face.
Right. So you have to appease him, and how do you do that?
You ask him for forgiveness.
Good. And what happens if it doesn't work? Right. So if you owe him money, what do you need to do?
Give it back.
Right. So. Right, this is several components, right? If there's a monetary crime, So then, right, payback. Right? In addition to that, you also have to appease, which is essentially, right, apology, right, apology plus being forgiven. And now what happens if he doesn't want to? Right now the Gemara adds the next thing. What happens if the person doesn't want to forgive you? So then what do you need to do? Right, how many times do you need to attempt to be meratzeh chavero?
Three times.
Right? Three times with a crowd. Right? By the end, if he doesn't want to forgive you, you bring a crowd and you are forgiven. What happens if the person dies?
You go to their grave with 10
right?
people.
Right? Right? Or a grave with minyan. Right? Grave with 10. So this is our original source. This is what we know. Now, if we want to get to our question, which is, okay, how does one apologize? Does the Gemara give us any hints, right? What hints do we have? What do we know from the Gemara?
Well, we know it can be public.
So we know that it can be, in certain cases, has to be public. Good. Right? But...
we still apologize directly.
Right, so in the original source, basically all we talk about is apologies in person. Right, which means that does the original source tell us one way or the other whether you're allowed to apologize not in person? Not really. Does anyone have any reason to believe in the Gemara that it has to be in person or that just how it normally happens?
It's just how it normally happens. Right? What
right.
alternative was there?
Good. So in the Bavli, it sounds like, right, we have no, from an original source, we have no evidence, right? It just happens to be in person. Right? What source, right, might say differently? Right, might. Right, we have another original source. If we're talking original sources, we have a Yerushalmi. What does the Yerushalmi say? Right, I'll read the Yerushalmi one more time. Right, Shmuel Amar Hahein Dechatal Chavrei. One who sins against his friend, Sarich Meimer Leisarach Dalach. He must say, I have wronged you. Vin Kible, if he accepts the apology, Hatavo, that's good. Vin Lo, and if he doesn't accept the apology, Maiti B'nei Nash Mephayas Lekameot. Then he needs to bring people there and apologize in front of them. Now, you could just read the Yerushalmi exactly the same way as the Bavli, right? You have to say to him. But the question is, how carefully do you read the question here, right? Say to him, right? How direct does it have to be? But fundamentally, from the primary sources, do you have strong evidence in one direction or the other whether apology has to be done in person? Anyone? Right? Strong evidence? I don't think so. Okay? So good. So now we move to the next thing. So then if we, right, if our original analysis of the source doesn't necessarily tell us it concretely, we now move to precedent. How did previous authorities weigh in and do their interpretations help us? So here we have, I gave you two interpretations from the Ein Yaakov and from the Efei Meret. Now I'm going to leave for a moment the problems here of being agadic commentaries because the poskim do bring them, so for the moment, I'll bracket that. But you have a machloket between the Efei Mar'eh and the Ein Yaakov. Commentaries on the Agadata, in this case, the Agadata of Yerushalmi. So what is their dispute? Right? They look at these primary texts, and what do they say? Someone else. Okay, why don't we try reading it together, and then you fill it in. Okay, I'll read it, and help me fill it in. Okay, so number four. This is the Efei Meret quoting the Ein Yaakov. He says, Sarach meimar le sarach dalach. So first, the Efei Meret quotes the Ein Yaakov. So this is a quote. Katav bal Ein Yaakov. Mikan nir'eh shehu minhag shel ta'ut, ma shenoagin bizmanenu, im yechta ish le'ish v'iknito bedvarim. It is a mistake what people do nowadays, that if someone wrongs his friend verbally, nichnas b'nehem emtzai, and they bring between them a go-between, literally, a middle person, oseh shalom, who makes peace, u'midaber ma'aluf shiratzeh lekabel piyus ha'olayiv, and he speaks with the hurt party and convinces him to be appeased. V'achar zorak damai yavau ha'olayiv l'vakesh mechila mimenu. And only afterwards does the person come and apologize himself. Ve'ein zu kavanat Shmuel. He said Shmuel wouldn't like this. Shmuel didn't intend for this. Elisha oleg ilech me'atzmo lifnei ha'aluv. The Yomer lo sarach alach. Look at Shmuel. He says the hurt one must go. The hurt, one who hurt must go to he who is hurt or she who is hurt and say, I have wronged you. Vim lo kiblo. If they don't accept, az yavian Hashem imo v'chozer lechalo panav v'fnei Hashem v'cholo. So he says, read the Bavli or the Yerushalmi, and there seems to be an order. The first thing you do is
you go to him,
right? You apologize just
privately.
Right. You to them, you to him, to her. If that doesn't work, you bring people to help you with the process. But how does Dan Yaakov read that? That not only can I not apologize, not in person, I can't even send someone to set the groundwork for me to apologize. And he says, V'chein yoded, yored dikduk lashon Shmuel, v'od yagid elav reyo, shemar v'imait tzarach lamez al kivrehu, v'ra'oi she'yomar she'alichal lefnechai v'amid, v'ein v'ein makdamara yediyam. Rak sh'olev yeilech matzmol, v'fayesa olev v'zora busha, v'abizayon heim lechaper alav. And now he gives you a justification. He says, why do I want you to go first, in person, without anyone setting the groundwork? Because Habusha v'habizayon, the embarrassment, the degradation that you feel, heim lechaper alav me'asher chata lechavero, they are part of what you need for atonement. Afilo hiknito ala bidvarim, even if you only wronged them in words. Ukshelech lefaisal kivro yolichem osar anashim yom evnei chata lechem levoni zeh shepashati lo me'asher lo mutar lach machulach. If he's dead, so then you go with the people, etc. So what does Dan Yaakov say? Right, he understands this source how. He says, what? Let's divide this into two things. The what and the why. Right? What does he say you need to do for an apology?
Apologize personally.
Personally? Without forewarning, right? Meaning no go-between. Even before you. Right? No? No go-between. Why? Because what does he understand the purpose of an apology is?
To be embarrassed.
Right? Right? The bizayon, the busha. Now, in other words, what does he think? Now, before someone said, we could plug something else in here. Right? Doesn't this have to be the embarrassment? It could be, it'll humble yourself, right? You need to feel contrition. But what is he really saying? Right? Who is the apology for?
Person who was hurt.
No.
You.
Good. Right? The sinner. Right? This is like vidui. You know, with God, I have to apologize. But he's saying the process of apologizing isn't just for the person who I harmed. It's not just that I need to elicit forgiveness. It's that I need to go to a process which hurts. Either because I think that metaphysically that gives me atonement because I'm embarrassed. Or if you want to talk more rationally, just to say, right, it humbles you. It's part of the process of changing yourself, forcing yourself to face the person that you hurt in person, right, without anybody going there to make it easy, without easing it, right? This needs to be hard for you, the sinner. The Yifei Mareh jumps in and says, V'lo matzati echreach. I found no reason to believe this. Right? This is not necessarily true. L'masha marsha tzarech sholev yilech matzmo. Dekeva disof sof holech lifai so. Because at the end of the day, look, you're going to get forgiveness. Malikach okach ma'achar sh'aluv mitpayes bekach. Who cares how you went? As long as the person forgave you. Va'afilo ma'aluv mitpayes mibli she'ilech Ha'olam etzlo klal shapirdam. And he says, therefore, even if I never apologize, but the person out of the goodness of their hearts forgives me, I am forgiven. Because what is the purpose of an apology, right? I never need to go, right? I never need to apologize. It's not the process, right? If I had to, right, divide it, right? The Ein Yaakov says, there's something about the process of apologizing that is important for the sinner. And what does he say? The Fei Mara says it's all about the result.
An apology is just a means to an end, which is, right, I need to elicit forgiveness. Nope.
No.
He says, I don't even have to apologize. If they forgive me, right? He's saying, when the Gemara says I need to apologize, it doesn't mean it. It means that I need to get them to forgive me. Normally, that only happens if I apologize. But who cares if I actually apologize? Now, before you ask your question. Yes.
It sounds like he makes an apology to some sort.
Correct. Right? He thinks that this is... Right? It's not about the apology at all. Right? It's just about getting the result. Now, do we have any customs that follow the Fei Mareh?
Yes.
What?
The mass apologies.
So, we'll come to that in a second. But, Erev Yom Kippur, in your Siddur, what does it say? What do you have right after Mincha?
Kol Nidre.
Before Kol Nidre. Who gets to shul early on Yom Kippur? And knows what it says before Kol Nidre in your Siddur? After that, it has a tefillah called Tefillat Zaka. And one of the things in Tefillat Zaka is a statement, I hereby forgive anyone who has ever sinned against me, and I don't want them to be punished on my behalf. Right? Does that make any sense according to Dan Yaakov?
No.
Zero. Right? Zero, because it's not about getting the result. The reason you apologize is for you as much as it is for them. You have to change. You have to feel better. You have to look them in the eye. For him, be embarrassed, be humbled, feel contrition. The Femaret says, I don't care. An apology is just a means to an end. If they forgive me without me asking, great. So now, there's a pretty easy application here. Well, sort of. Here, help me apply it now. According to the Fei Mareh, if I have a mass apology, however I do it, Facebook, WhatsApp, email, I don't know, can you do that on Instagram? I don't know what you would do. My Erev Yom Kippur story, okay? Apologizing, I don't know. Whatever you do, is that meaningful, according to Fei Mareh?
Well, yeah, it is.
According to Fei Mareh.
You don't need to apologize,
yeah.
You just need to listen.
Yes, now, obviously he has a practical problem, which is if I don't know that people forgave me, then I'm going to have to figure that out. But fundamentally, if this works, right, if everyone looks at it and says, I forgive you, so then, is it enough? Yes, because he thinks about the result. What about Dan Yaakov? Almost definitely not. Right, because he says that this is critical. The process, the feeling of embarrassment, right, that I go through by having to ask for forgiveness, matters. Now, you see how the application here, right, again, methodologically, the original source didn't provide so much information here. But you had two fundamental traditions in the, right, interpreters of this source, of whether, when the Gemara says you need to apologize, it actually means that? Or that's just because that's the normal way of getting to a given result? When we move to application, right, this helps us. But not 100%. Right? Not 100%, yeah.
Okay, but doing a mass apology, I feel like the Ian Yaakov would be like, okay, like that's kind of fine because you're still going through the process of doing the apology. It's not like someone just forgave you.
Good, but what does he say? What do you need? Right? He says you need bisayon. You need to, like, be ashamed. He says you can't even send someone. Right? And Yaakov is extreme. He says you can't even tell someone to go to your friend and say, I'm going to apologize.
Right? But doing a mass apology is still you writing out everything.
Good. So here's where, right, and I can't prove it, but here's where it gets complicated, which is, and this is why no matter how much precedent you have, there's always going to be a gap. Because here, when we're applying it, right, we can focus on two things in the Ein Yaakov. One is, the Ein Yaakov says two things. One is that I need it to be direct, right? The other is that it needs to cause, right, bizayon. If you focus, as I am, on this, that it needs to actually cause bizayon, so then a mass apology we're going to hide behind the screen doesn't help. But remind me your name again. Abigail. But Abigail says that maybe all that Yaakov really wants is this, is direct. And then ironically, right, sending someone in advance, right, is in a certain sense less direct because someone went there first as opposed to I directly communicate. Now, I don't know if that's true. Maybe I wouldn't go that direction for a mass apology on like Facebook, but I could hear that for, let's say, a direct email. Right? Here's where you gotta focus. What does he really want? Is he worried about the directness? Because maybe a pointed email is gonna work. But on the other hand, if he says that it really needs bizayon, which is what it sounds like, it could be that hiding behind an email wouldn't be good, or it depends on the type of email. Right? You can have an email which is right long and detailed, and I pour out my heart and I really express why I feel bad, right? But sometimes even those emails, people do that not, right? Sometimes people do those emails because it's easier to express themselves in writing, right? Because they can be more detailed. Sometimes they do it so they don't have to look people face to face. My guess is that if you wrote even that long email to hold back from seeing them face to face for the Yaakov, that might not be good. But you see how this sort of little halacha, or this little halacha question, forces us to ask, well, what is an apology? What are we even trying to do in Erev Yom Kippur, right? And then how does that play itself out in the modern world? Yeah. Good. So number five, look at Mishnah Berurah. Mishnah Berurah takes a compromise position. He says, "V'nachon sheilech batzmo elav v'lo yishlach tchilam tzayishir atzel lekabel piyusim." It's the right thing to do to not send someone in advance, to go yourself. V'imkashya elav leilech batzmo tchilah. But if it's hard, or it's going to be, he's more likely to forgive you if you send someone in between. Mishnah Berurah brings a third possibility, which is
whatever will elicit.
Well, this is the best, right? The Yaakov is the best, but if it's impossible, there's some value to all other types. Now, admittedly, he's still talking about sending a go-between and then eventually apologizing in person. He's not talking about doing it indirectly. But Rebavadi Yosef, number six, right? Now remember, until now, in Yaakov, Yifei Mara, even the Mishnah Berurah are talking about you eventually get there and apologize in person. But the jump they're not talking about, is what if I communicate indirectly or less directly than in person? Phone, email, WhatsApp. Good. So Rebavadi Yosef, who's now living in a world with even more communicative technology than the Mishnah Berurah, and Mishnah Berurah is living with a lot of it. He's already living in the 20th century, right? Rav Avadya Yosef is a bit later, his second half of the 20th century, takes these principles and now moves it to communication, right? Meaning, there's no person in between us, but there is technology between us. So if you look in 6, he writes, someone who sinned against his friend, and now he regrets it, or she regrets it. And they want to appease their friend. But he's embarrassed, or she's embarrassed to go in person. Can I send a letter? Can I call? And now he suddenly equates this conversation of sending a messenger or go-between, right, with sending a messenger and not then following up yourself or communicating indirectly. Right? And he says the principles here, as we'll see, help him analyze this question. Now, the first thing he says, I'm gonna summarize for you outside. Okay? So Rabbi Shua Pinto, writing on Rabbi Lazar on the Mishnah, has a very wild claim. And that's the following. Rabbi Lazar had said, well, what was the pasuk that Rabbi Lazar had quoted to prove that you don't get forgiveness unless you ask your friend for forgiveness? Mikol chatotechem lifnei Hashem titaru. Right? Mikol chatotechem lifnei Hashem titaru. So Rishua Pinto argues that the key to understanding him are these words. Mikol chatotechem. And how does he understand it? What is mikol chatotechem? What does that mean?
from all your sins. So Yeshua Pinto comes up with a very wild claim that is important to think about in Erev Yom Kippur. And he says as follows. What Elazar is saying is the following. Tshuva and kapara are all or nothing. If you don't ask a single friend for forgiveness, do you know what you don't get?
Kapara.
Kapara for any sins. Bin Adam Lamakom or Bin Adam Lachavero. He reads the Pasuk. Mikol Chatotechem. If you can get forgiveness from all your sins, then Lifnei Hashem Titaru, you will be purified. And if you haven't done everything you can for every single sin, then zero. Yom Kippur does nothing for you. Yes?
What if we really, really dislike a reading of an original source, like, and we don't think that it's true to the meaning of the also?
Good. So, what do you do?
I don't know. I'm asking you.
So, well, if you have someone else on your side, then that's pretty easy. If you don't, then it gets more complicated. Now, in this case, you do.
Okay.
So, Rav Ovadia quotes several poskim who agree with this lehalacha. But he says this is just wrong for two reasons. He says, first of all, even Yeshua Pinto only said this within Rabbi Elazar and thinks that Rabbi Kiva disagrees, and that's why Rabbi Kiva comes in and says, no, God is your mikvah. God will purify you, right? Don't worry about it so much, right? So first of all, he says Rabbi Kiva disagrees. So he said there's two reasons to reject this halacha. One is that Rabbi Yeshua Pinto himself thinks this is Rabbi Elazar and not Rabbi Kiva. And number two is maybe we don't paskin like this, right? Okay. But what he says, what he argues is true is the following. The Pri Chadash, and this is on top of the next page, argues something that I think is much more plausible, which is the following. Every interpersonal sin is, as we pointed out over here, what is it? It's also what? Every interpersonal sin is also what? It's also in the Malakam, right? God told you not to hurt your friends. So he argues that while it's not true that if you don't get forgiveness for a single sin, you don't get forgiveness for anything, he says, you know what is true? You can on Yom Kippur say to God, listen, she is a jerk, and I'm not willing to ask her for forgiveness what I did to her. But God, between you and me, you forgive me, I will feel bad about it. I'll leave the sin. I won't do it again, right? I'll admit to you that I'm wrong. But I'm willing to swallow the fact that she doesn't forgive me this year. I'm okay with that. But you forgive me for your part. And when I get around to it, when I'm up to it, I'll ask forgiveness from my friend. Right? But at least forgive me for the man-God component of the interpersonal sins. The Pri Chadash says, right?
Fine.
No, no go. That is ridiculous. Right? He says, until you ask forgiveness, right, you get no kapara, not even the God component, for your interpersonal sins. Right? God will hold up his end, right, of forgiveness until you go and ask forgiveness. So that's his background. And then he says in his the large paragraph over here on the second page, he says, Me'ata navo le'etzem ha'she'ila. Said, let's go to the question. So he quotes the Rambam, he quotes Shulchan Aruch, and then in the middle, he quotes the Ein Yaakov and the Yifei Mareh that we just saw. So look, if you go in, like halfway through that big paragraph, he says, L'cha'ora yish la'ir. Before I paskin, I want to bring a source for you back from
the original source.
The original source. I want to introduce a new original source. You know what I want to introduce? Yosef and his brothers. Because the Pasuk says that Yosef's brothers, when Yaakov died, what did they do?
They asked forgiveness.
How did they ask forgiveness? It says, Vayitzavu al Yosef lemor. They commanded to Yosef saying, which sounds like, right, probably means they sent... They sent a messenger to go to Yosef first before they went to sort of set the groundwork. So he says, there's another original source that disproves at least the extreme claim of the Ein Yaakov, that I'm not allowed to send a messenger in advance. Now, that's not necessarily true. You could just say, look, they wanted to, you know, they didn't want to die. And this wasn't just about forgiveness. This is about protecting their lives. So, and he notes that in one of the in one midrash, the shlichim are just some of the brothers that Yosef had a better relationship with, namely the daughter, the sons of the shvachot. But he says, okay, maybe that's not a good proof. But he says, lahalacha, oh, many people quote the Ein Yaakov. Right? Many people quote the Ein Yaakov. And he says, well, the Ein Yaakov, if we look at it, not just what he says, which is you're not allowed to do it indirectly. Sorry. The Ein Yaakov says you can't even do it directly if you had a go-between before. He says what he's really telling you, it's not about the process, it's about the, right, it's what do you feel in the process, right? It's not direct versus indirect. It's how do you emotionally relate to this asking for forgiveness? And he says many poskim bring the Ein Yaakov, which leads me to believe that there is value in asking in an apology to actually being forced to face the person face to face, feeling the embarrassment, feeling the contrition. And he says many poskim quote it. Now he says it's true that people like the Mishnah Berurah say that's only lechatchila. So that's my conclusion also, that the same principle that leads the Ein Yaakov to say you should go without sending someone in advance so you feel the pain means that you shouldn't send a letter. If there's no other way, they won't forgive you otherwise, you can't get to them before Yom Kippur, without, so fine. But ideally, you should force yourself to feel the embarrassment, feel the discomfort, feel the contrition, because what you see from the fact that people quote Ein Yaakov is that they actually care about the process that you go through, the sinner goes through, when they ask forgiveness. Now, based on this, so what would you say if we brought it right back to our question? What are you allowed to do? What are you not allowed to do? What would you say? Right, you have a machloket here. So according to the Yifei Ma'ariv, it's all about the result. So what would you say? What's the only question you have to ask when you do a mass apology? Did they forgive you? Right? But assuming they forgive you, it's fine. Now realistically, that may not help because you won't know, but fundamentally there's no problem. But according to the Ein Yaakov, and according to the Ravadia, then expand the Ein Yaakov, the Ein Yaakov says, I can't even send someone to go before me. And Ravadia says, it sounds like the issue isn't, did I go to him first or second? It sounds like, did I change? Was I forced to face what I did wrong in the process of apologizing? Yes or no? So now if I asked you lahalacha, what would you say? Right? What's the right question to ask now? I'm not going to paskin because I don't necessarily know the reality. But what's the right question to ask according to the Ein Yaakov? Right? Is it meaningful to have a mass apology on whatever medium you're going to use? What's the right question to ask?
Are you personally invested?
Yeah. Does it not change them? Does it not get them to forgive me, but does this force me to face up to what I did? And what I want to just point out methodologically is, and this is a relatively simple question, right? I went through a few basic sources, but a question that maybe we haven't thought about enough, like, why do I apologize? We're forced to ask that by facing a modern thing that people just do, right? This is how contemporary halacha sometimes works. If we look at something, we maybe never thought it through enough because we just sort of went with it. But now if we ask, well, here's a phenomenon in halacha that people do that has halachic significance, let me analyze it. And in the process of analyzing it, you got to a much bigger question, which is not, can you apologize on Facebook? It's, what am I trying to accomplish? And they started to make trouble when I apologize to my friends. Am I trying to get them to forgive me? Or am I trying to force myself to change? And if that's the question I really have to ask is, how direct does it need to be? Right? You could have different levels. You could say, I disagree with the Ein Yaakov. I don't think that sending someone in advance to tell them I'm coming to apologize and to set the groundwork takes away the pain from me. But I think that sending a WhatsApp does. I think that a long, detailed email forces me to own up to what I did. But a text doesn't. I think a phone call forces me to own up to it, but an email doesn't. But the question now is different. The question is
on the level of application, right? And the question in the application is, I know what I want. I want a process that forces me to go through with that pain, that contrition. And now the question I got to ask is this it? Right? That's what we've boiled this down fundamentally, right? To first is the precedent question. Which precedent do you accept? Ife Mareh, the Ein Yaakov. Then, Rabbi Vadi's expansion. How do I apply it when we're not just talking about sending an intermediary, but we're talking about using technology as my intermediary, where there's a directness, but also I'm behind, right, the screen, which protects me. And then I have to talk about the application, which is, how does that actually affect me, and does it accomplish what it's supposed to? And so through this, like, little halakhic question, you actually get to a fundamental question, is, go back to the original source, look through the precedent, and ask, what does the tradition tell me I'm supposed to experience in this apology? And now, even when you just apologize to your friend, suddenly you have two different perspectives. Am I apologizing just because I want you to forgive me, because I owe you something? It's a transactional, as someone said, right? I apologize, you give me forgiveness, we're done. Right? I owe you an apology. Or am I apologizing because it's the only way that I'm really going to feel what I did wrong? Right? I'm going to feel how I hurt you to prevent me from doing it. Just like I confess to God to change me, I confess to you to change me. Let me throw out one more thought on this. Let's say we say that we like the Ein Yaakov. We think that tshuva ideally should be one that has contrition and makes me feels my sin. Does that mean there's no value whatsoever to these mass apologies? No. So one, why might there be value?
There's something, you know, nice and comforting to other people about mass apologies.
Perfect.
Maybe they'll read it and be like, oh, forgive
perfect. Them. I think that's exactly what I want to sort of end on. Is that the Or Zeruah says something really quite wild. The Or Zeruah, Rabbi Yitzchak of Vienna, is one of the leading German Balei HaTosfot. And he asked the following question. Why do we apologize on Erev Yom Kippur? Right? Someone on this side of the room said, right, do you have to apologize on Erev Yom Kippur? What if I did it months ago when I actually sinned it, right? Why is it that we apologize at Yom Kippur? So, there's two possibilities. One is simply, I'll come back in a second. One is that what? We apologize at Yom Kippur because that's when we get around to it. Really, we should do it whenever we sin, right? But if we haven't gotten around to it, we do it at Yom Kippur. The other possibility is that, right, that there's something like important about Erev Yom Kippur. So the Or Zeruah says something fascinating. He says, the reason that you apologize in Erev Yom Kippur is not just because that's when it counts. Now it's time for tshuva. He says the following. The Midrash says in Pirkei Elazar that one of the themes of Yom Kippur is that we want to be like angels. Now, in what ways do we try to be like angels in Yom Kippur? White clothes. We don't eat. We don't drink. We stand with our feet together like angels. But look at what he quotes in the middle. He says, it's three lines in. Where the Satan doesn't see sin for the Jews in Yom Kippur. You have this nation who are angels. Angels don't wear shoes, so neither do the Jews on Yom Kippur. Right, we stand on one foot. We don't eat and drink. And then he says, "Ma malachei asharet shalom b'neihem, kach Israel shalom b'neihem." Just like the angels have peace, so we have peace. And he introduces this fascinating concept that maybe the reason we apologize in Erev Yom Kippur is not only because, you know, now we're being judged and now we need forgiveness, but part of the experience of Yom Kippur is that we're all in this together, and we have put aside our differences. Right? Because angels don't fight, so we don't fight. And I think at that level, we could argue, potentially, that even if, on your personal level of tshuva, these mass apologies aren't meaningful, there is a level at which part of what we want to do in Yom Kippur is create a general goodwill where
we're at peace with everyone. And in that sense, using the technology that we have to spread goodwill as far as, right, as far as we can, right, there is a secondary level, right? Not on my personal kapara, maybe it doesn't work, but if part of the reason I ask for apologies and everyone giver isn't just because this is where it counts, because I'm being judged, but because I want there to be a feeling of peace, so then arguably there is a secondary value, even if I've even gotten kapara from people, but just to say, like, we're in the spirit of forgiveness. I forgive everyone, I hope everyone forgives me. The Ur Zeruah is introducing that actually is halachically valuable because it accomplishes a secondary goal of Yom Kippur, which is creating a society where we've, at least for a day, put aside our differences and we feel like there is a level of shalom. So, what I hope this exercise showed you is that even in the smallest of halachic shailas, right, modern questions force us to go back to the original sources, sometimes get new insights in the original sources, the precedent, realize the complexity of application, and going through that process helps us sharpen the fundamental principles of the halakhic system. Right? So we both understand how to apply it, but in our attempt to apply, sometimes we end up understanding the principles more because the new question forced us to reassess every stage of that process. This is a relatively easy one, which maybe is scary, I don't know. But we're going to try to do this with some more complicated cases as the year goes on, and use it, as I said, both to understand the halakhic process, but also to use the opportunities of contemporary issues to force us and re-understand the principles that guide the halakha from the beginning to the end. Okay? With that, ikhtiva v'chatimah tova.